grinding, demoralizing duty of elder care. It's not that she doesn't love her mother, but it's so hard and so sad. The dependency, the embarrassing bodily needs, the fact that her mother doesn't even know who she is half the time. It completely saps her creativity and makes it hard to work. That's why it's so important that she take this time away to finish her book. Her sisters only step up when she's out of town on assignment, which has been infrequently of late. They have been complacent, depending on her all the time, visiting their mother less and less. Their own families are more important, and Candace doesn't have a family. Candace can do it. She finds herself mouthing the words, silently and sarcastically, automatically, with a snarky expression on her face. Well, if this book is as good as she thinks it's going to be, as good as her agent says it is, then they will all have to adjust their thinking. The family dynamic will have to change. She drags her eyes from the swirling darkness outside the window back to the screen of her laptop. She's let herself get off track. She ought to write another page before she goes down to dinner. She checks her watch and realizes she's missed cocktail hour. It's a sad thing for a writer to miss cocktail hour. She looks again at the screen of the laptop in front of her, regrets that last paragraph. It will have to go. She blocks it out and hits delete. Candace takes off her reading glasses and rubs her eyes. Maybe she needs a break. She will carry on after dinner. There will be wine with dinner. She tells herself again that she had to get away from her mother to finish this manuscript. She's trying not to feel guilty about it. She has to write the last 10,000 words, but she still has to eat. Candace has a lot riding on this book. It's the first thing of her own that she's written in a long time. For almost 2 decades now, she has eked out a living as an author of nonfiction, but more and more often lately, she's been ghostwriting other people's books, everything from self-help to business books. Except most of these geniuses aren't particularly successful. So she's never thought their wisdom was worth the paper it was printed on. As long as they paid her, she didn't care. When she started out, it was a good living. She got to keep her own hours, and she met some interesting people. She got to travel, paid. And when she was younger, this was a valuable perk. Now she would like to travel a lot less and get paid a lot more. She's hoping this book, her own book, is going to make her fortune. Closing the laptop, Candace gets up, looks at herself critically in the full-length mirror, and decides she can't really go down in yoga pants. She puts on a decent skirt and tights and throws a silk scarf around her neck. She brushes her hair into a new, tidy ponytail, applies fresh lipstick, and heads downstairs. Friday, 7 p.m. At dinner, they all move into the dining room. The meal has been set up as a buffet. There's a long table along one wall, laden with covered silver chafing dishes, platters of salads, and baskets of various breads and rolls. A glittering chandelier provides soft lighting. There's a scattering of tables in the dining room, some for two, some for four, with white linen cloths. Soon there is the slight clatter of silver cutlery against good china as the guests collect plates and serve themselves. David Paley slowly fills his plate, lingering over the roast beef, horseradish, and various hot side dishes, each is escalloped potatoes and asparagus, wondering where he should sit. He supposes he could sit down with anyone except the engaged couple, who look like they want to be alone and have already nabbed a table for two in the corner. A woman he hasn't seen before, about his own age, she must be the writer, has taken a table for two. He supposes he could join her, but she seems rather forbidding, looking pointedly at a magazine on her table as she eats. She hadn't said hello to anyone when she entered the dining room. He would most like to join the dark-haired woman, Gwen, and her rather jumpy friend. Gwen and Riley have already filled their plates, and are sitting at a table set for four. He walks over and asks politely, "May I join you?" The two women look up at him, surprised. Two pairs of nervous eyes size him up. Riley is glassy-eyed from too much drink too fast, he surmises. Gwen, he notices, is even prettier up close. Her face is pale and fine, and she has lovely dark hair. Her features are subdued rather than flamboyant, the kind of face he imagines he could look at for a long time. He's surprised at himself for thinking this. He's only just met her. He suddenly wishes that she was here alone this weekend, like him, and that they could get to know one another. As it is, it's rather awkward, especially as her friend, Riley, looks as if she would prefer not to have company. He sees Gwen glance at Riley, who shrugs her shoulders, neither yes nor no. Not quite rude, but not welcoming either. Gwen turns to him and says, "Yes, of course. Please do." He sits beside Riley, across from Gwen, so that he can look at her. "Are you here alone?" she asks, and then blushes slightly. He's charmed by the color coming into her cheeks. "Yes," he says, "I'm on my own. I came up here to get away, to think about things." He's not sure why he's telling her this. "I see," she says politely. He feels uncomfortable talking about himself, but he doesn't want to seem too nosy either by asking her about herself. It doesn't leave much to talk about, he realizes. "You're a defense attorney," Gwen says, when the silence verges on becoming awkward.
"Yes,"
he says.
Oddly, he can't think of anything else to say.
He finds that he's tongue-tied. He's not usually, but he can feel her friend oozing barely veiled hostility, and it's disconcerting. "That must be interesting," Gwen says gamely, "and challenging, although probably exhausting, too."
"Yes,"
he agrees. For a moment, there is only the chink of cutlery on fine china as they dine on their roast beef. David finds himself noticing the flickering candlelight reflected in the glass of the windows.
"What brings you here this weekend?"
he asks finally. Perhaps her friend will go upstairs, and they can sit in front of the fire and talk. He would like that. Gwen glances at Riley. "We just wanted to get away, for a girls' weekend," she says.
"Oh."
There's not much he can say to that. He can hardly crash a girls' weekend. "Riley and I were at journalism school together. She's with the New York Times." He flicks a nervous glance at Riley, inwardly dismayed. "But I never actually worked as a journalist," Gwen confides.
"Is that right?" David says,
his mind drifting from the conversation.
"What do you do instead?"
"I work in public relations for a small firm in New York City."
"And do you enjoy it?"
But he is already thinking of an exit strategy. "For the most part," she says, "it can be exciting, but it can also be a grind. Like a lot of jobs, it sounds more glamorous than it is." They talk for a while, about nothing much. When they are about to start on coffee and dessert, English trifle and chocolate brownies have appeared on the long buffet table. Riley, slurring her words slightly, turns and looks directly at him and says,
"I've been trying to place you. What did you say your name was again?"
He looks back at her, refusing to shrink from her very direct gaze.
"David Paley,"
he says, waiting for it. She's a journalist, after all. They have no compunction about anything. He knows his weekend is about to be ruined. Beverly Sullivan struggles through her meal. She wonders how it can be possible that after 20 years of marriage, there is nothing to talk about. Without the kids there, interrupting, distracting, it seems there is little for them to say to one another. They didn't used to be like this. They used to be good together.
All those years of eating with the kids has made them lose the knack of conversation. They should have hired more babysitters, gone out by themselves to restaurants more, she thinks regretfully, like the experts always advise. Unfortunately, she is positioned so that she is looking directly at the outrageously attractive engaged couple alone together in the corner. They do all the things couples in love do. They look into each other's eyes. They smile excessively, touch each other whenever they can. Every once in a while, they laugh. They're so young, she thinks. They have no idea. It's a good thing, she thinks, that the guests at the other tables are so engrossed in each other that no one seems to notice that she and her husband are hardly speaking to each other. He still seems annoyed about there not being any Wi-Fi, unless he's actually annoyed about something else. She can't think what it could be. The hotel is lovely. He agreed to come here. Perhaps he's feeling stressed and guilty about not staying at home and catching up on work. Finally, she says his name to get his attention, and when she has it, she asks quietly, "Is something the matter?"
"What?"
he says.
"No."
He takes another forkful of the excellent roast beef. "You've hardly said a word to me since we got here," she says gently, careful not to sound antagonistic. In fact, she's a bit surprised. At home, they have so little time for each other, but they are not deliberately neglectful of each other, merely too busy. Something's changed, and she doesn't know what it is.
"I have a lot on my mind," he says a bit defensively.
"Do you want to tell me about it?" she asks. He looks at her, as if considering what to tell her. It makes her feel uneasy. Maybe there's a problem she's not aware of.
"It's just work," he says, "but I'd rather not talk about work this weekend."
"Fine," she agrees, taking another sip of wine and giving him a tentative smile. "We came up here to relax and enjoy ourselves, after all." She tries to set her uneasiness aside. She has a nice surprise in store for him that will take his mind off whatever is bothering him. Chapter 6. Lauren watches the guests at the other tables with interest. She has always been curious about people, observing them, trying to figure out what makes them tick, studying what they do. Why does that woman, Riley, at the table with Gwen and David, seems so on edge, for instance? She keeps scanning the room as if expecting someone to steal her dinner. Ian has slipped his foot out of his shoe, and now he's touching her leg under the table with his socked toe. "Are you flirting with me?" she asks coyly, her attention drawn back to the man sitting across from her. He's terribly appealing, but she's never been able to focus on just one thing for long. Her quick mind darts all over the place. Fortunately, he doesn't seem to mind. He's almost as interested in their fellow guests as she is. "What's up with that Riley?" Lauren asks him in a quiet voice.
"I don't know. She looks like she's escaped from detox or something,"
Ian says, his voice a whisper. Lauren shifts her attention now to the attorney, who's talking to Gwen. She's been observing his body language throughout the meal. Something has changed. He's sitting back now, stiffly, as if someone has said something he doesn't like. Just a little while ago, he was leaning in toward the pretty Gwen, smiling at her, tilting his head to one side, like a male bird looking for a mate.
Perhaps Riley just told him to fuck off.
She lets her gaze travel to the corner, where the engaged couple is dining. She narrows her eyes. She'd taken a rather instant dislike to Dana while they were having cocktails in the lobby. Perhaps it was simply because of her rather intimidating beauty. Perhaps it was the way she ostentatiously waved that diamond ring around. She didn't exactly stick it under anyone's nose and say, "This is my engagement ring, isn't it gorgeous?" but she was constantly fluttering her perfectly manicured hands around, just begging people to notice it. The large diamond glittered when she smoothed her hair, when she picked up her champagne glass. Her eyes sparkled when she looked at her fiancé. Everything about her was shiny and bright. She has a bright, shiny life, Lauren thinks. Then she directs her attention to the man to whom she's engaged. What does she think of him? She thinks he is someone who collects bright, shiny things. She moves on to the woman, who must be Candace White, dining alone at a table for two, pretending to read a magazine. But really, she's staring at David, the attorney, who is positioned so that he is unaware of it. Lauren wonders why Candace is staring at David. Perhaps she finds him attractive. He certainly is attractive. Anyone can see that. Well, good luck to her, Lauren thinks. He's obviously interested in the younger, more fetching Gwen. Now Candace has turned her attention away from David, and she's staring rather hard at Dana and Matthew. They are a good-looking couple, but something registers on her face, as if she recognizes Dana from somewhere. Or maybe it's Matthew she recognizes. Lauren can't be sure. But it seems now as if her interest is divided equally between the shiny young couple and the understated attorney. The writer herself is rather austere-looking, dark hair pulled back from her face in a tight ponytail, strong bones, no-nonsense skirt and sweater, equally no-nonsense eyeglasses. She looks like she might make a competent nurse. The only flourish is a pretty scarf around her neck. Not unattractive, but getting on, maybe pushing 40. Lauren wonders idly about the book she's writing. It's so pleasant here, Lauren thinks, in this enchanting dining room, with the lights low and the wind howling outside, slamming at the windows, like something wanting to get in. Dana takes another sip of the excellent wine, tears her gaze away from Matthew for a moment, and looks around the dining room. How surprising life can be. She's just thinking what a small world it is, when suddenly there is a loud, ominous crash. Dana jumps a little in her seat. She notices everybody else raising their eyes from their meals, startled. Bradley, replacing dishes over by the buffet table, smiles and says, "Don't worry, that's just the sound of snow sliding off the roof." "Goodness," Dana says, laughing a little too loudly. "It sounds like someone fell off the roof." "Doesn't it?" Bradley agrees. Riley has the alcohol to thank for being able to keep herself together. She knows she made a bit of a spectacle of herself in the lounge, knocking back wine and champagne like a sailor. But she's a journalist. She can hold her liquor. And she's been self-medicating more than she'd care to admit these last few years, since she started going to the ugly, dangerous parts of the world. She hadn't enjoyed the meal. She hadn't liked the way the attorney insinuated himself into a place at their dining table. He was so obviously interested in Gwen. That bothered her. Riley always used to be the one men were interested in, not Gwen. Riley was the striking one, the one men noticed and pursued. Not tonight. Not anymore. This, perhaps more than anything else, has brought home to her just how much she's changed. But it's not jealousy that makes her wary of the attorney. There's something about him, some memory floating around at the back of her brain, nudging at her thoughts. But she can't grasp it. His name is familiar. There's some whiff of scandal about it. She wishes that there were an internet connection here. She could have Googled him. Although Gwen was obviously flattered by his interest, Riley had thrown cold water on their little romance by asking him bluntly about who he was. Judging by the way he clammed up when he found out she was a journalist, she's pretty sure she's on to something. He'd skipped dessert and excused himself, saying that he was going to visit the library. Gwen has been quiet since he left. She's sorry that Gwen has to be disappointed like this, but Riley has always been protective of her from the time they were roommates. This weekend was supposed to be about Gwen helping Riley, but Riley has slipped again into her old role. It feels good, especially for someone who has trouble getting through the most basic aspects of her day. Riley says, "Shall we go up? I'm pretty tired." Gwen hesitates. "I'm not that tired, actually," she says. "I think I might go stop by the library, get a book," she adds, averting her eyes. Riley is annoyed. "I thought you brought a book," she says coldly. They both know this is true. They both know this is about Gwen choosing to go up with Riley or to spend more time with the attractive lawyer. Riley wants Gwen to choose her. She wonders what kind of friend that makes her, a protective one or a needy one. "Are you okay going up on your own?" Gwen asks. "I won't be too long." "Oh, don't worry about me," Riley says curtly. "I'll be fine." Friday, 8:25 p.m. David finds himself alone in the library, a large room in a back corner of the hotel, to the left of the grand staircase, beyond a sitting room. It's like something out of a Victorian novel, a cross between a library and a men's smoking room. Like the bar at the front of the hotel, it's rather handsome. There's a large fireplace against the west wall. Above it hangs an antique hunting rifle. Above that, a buck's head with an impressive spread of antlers. It looks down at him with a glassy eye. There's a worn Persian carpet on the hardwood floor. An old sofa sits at a right angle to the fireplace, a pair of chairs facing it. French doors appear to open out to a veranda, but it's hard to tell with it being so dark outside. In the corner nearest the door is a large writing desk, which David briefly admires. But what he likes most are the beautifully made bookshelves. David touches them and admires the craftsmanship that went into them. The bookshelves are stuffed with every kind of book, from old leather-bound sets to hardcovers and tattered paperbacks. It's all very orderly, with little brass plates reading fiction, mystery, nonfiction, history, biography. He thinks of Bradley. He suspects this is his handiwork. He pulls an interesting-looking book from a lower shelf, a coffee table book, really, full of photographs of the failed Shackleton expedition. It seems oddly suited to this room. There's a dim overhead light, but now David also switches on a lamp resting on a side table and sits down in the deep leather armchair. What could be nicer than to sit by a fire in this lovely room and read about the struggles of the ill-fated crew of the Endurance at the South Pole? But the fire hasn't been lit, and the room is a bit chilly. He thinks regretfully of Gwen. How unfortunate that her friend is a damned journalist with the Times. He will stay away from both of them for the rest of the weekend. He doesn't need anyone dredging up his past. He becomes absorbed in his book, until he is interrupted by the sound of a woman's voice. "Is that you, David?" It's Gwen, and in spite of his earlier resolution, his heart leaps up. "Yes." He turns to look at her, standing in the doorway, and sees that she is alone. "I remembered you saying you were going to the library." How lovely she looks, he thinks, getting up out of his armchair. "It's perfect," she says, gazing around the room.
"Yes, isn't it?"
he agrees. Somehow, he knew she would appreciate it, too.
"I wonder where everyone is,"
David muses. He feels awkward, adolescent. "Riley is tired and has gone up to bed," Gwen offers shyly. "I think some of the others might still be in the dining room, having nightcaps."
"I can ask Bradley to light the fire in here," he says.
She nods, but he can't tear himself away from her to find Bradley just yet. Together, they begin to peruse the shelves. He enjoys standing beside her, while the storm rages just outside. After a particularly loud gust of wind, they both look toward the French doors.
Do you think it's going to get worse? She asks.
I don't care if it does,
he thinks, but he doesn't say it aloud. He'd like nothing better than to be stranded here with her.
I don't know,
he says. What shall I pick? She wonders out loud as he stands close to her.
He points to the large book he'd chosen earlier, open on the coffee table where he left it. I'm reading about a tragic expedition to the South Pole.
Perfect for tonight. She wanders along the shelves, dragging her index finger along the surface. Something seems to catch her eye, and she pulls a volume from its place.
Oh, I've heard about this one, she says.
I've been meaning to read it. David reads the title. The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher, or The Murder at Road Hill House. I love a good murder mystery, don't you? She says. Chapter 7. Friday, 8:50 p.m. After dinner, Ian escorts Lauren, they are both a little tipsy, up the grand staircase. He can't wait to get her into bed. Their room is located on the third floor, at the end of the hall. When they arrive there, Lauren fumbles with the key, and Ian idly notices another door near theirs. He suspects it opens onto another staircase that goes down the back of the building, presumably emptying out somewhere close to the kitchen. It would have been the servants' staircase. The help would never have used the main staircase, which makes such a grand statement in the lobby. He puts his hand on the door and pushes it open. He stares down the rather narrow, plain wooden staircase that winds below, dusty and dimly lit. What are you doing? Lauren asks.
Just looking, he says.
What's on your dirty mind, Ian?
She is on his dirty mind.
He grabs her hand and pulls her to him.
Come with me, baby,
he says, nuzzling her neck. He slowly unbuttons her blouse.
Come on. No one will see.
She protests softly as he pulls her into the stairwell. Henry and Beverly return to their room on the second floor after dinner.
I think I'll read a bit before bed,
Henry says. I'm going to take a bath, Beverly tells him. She slips into the marble bathroom, taking with her the costly, sexy new nightgown that she'd bought in anticipation of this weekend. Henry doesn't even notice what she's up to, his nose already in a book. It's been such a long time since they've made love, what with teenagers in nearby bedrooms, and the two of them both so tired and irritable at the end of the day, the physical part of their marriage has suffered. Time just slips away from you, but she's going to make an effort. She hangs the new nightgown, champagne silk with ivory lace, on the back of the door, and admires it for a moment while the bathtub fills. Henry hasn't seen it yet. He'll be surprised. It's been a long time since she's worn proper lingerie. She's embarrassed to think of the tatty pajamas she usually wears, day in, day out. This silky nightgown will make her feel attractive again. She adds bubbles to the bath, and as she gets into the tub and sinks below the bubbles, she decides that this weekend is going to be the beginning of a new start for her and Henry. Perhaps they will sleep late and have breakfast in bed, like they used to a long time ago. She emerges from the bathroom a short time later, feeling radiant in champagne silk, smelling of roses, her skin soft, and approaches the bed. She looks at Henry sitting up in bed with his book, and when he lifts his head from the page, she smiles at him coquettishly, though she suddenly feels shy. How ridiculous. But he doesn't respond the way she expects. He looks more dismayed than anything. He certainly doesn't look at her as if he's pleased, as if he finds her attractive. It's a shock. He recovers quickly and says,
I'm sorry, honey. I'm just,
So tired. It's like a slap, even if she's only getting her own words thrown back at her. She feels her face go hot, and tears start to burn her eyes. She's so hurt that she can't think of anything to say. Perhaps she has misjudged things badly. I thought we came up here to be together, she says, fighting tears. You don't seem that interested. He gives a big exhale and puts down his book. Then he says quietly, maybe it's too late. Too late? He can't possibly mean that. He can't. Now she starts to cry, sloppily. She's hurt and scared and embarrassed, standing there in her filmy gown that hides nothing. That was the point. But now she wishes she'd never bought the damn thing, never popped into that fancy lingerie store a couple of weeks ago, blushing and hopeful. Suddenly, she wishes they'd never come to this damn place, that she'd never had the idea. She doesn't want to see her marriage fall completely apart. She should have left well enough alone. Perhaps they could have gone on amiably ignoring one another, being too busy to examine their lives, their relationship, focusing on the kids, who still very much need them. She's not sure she really wants to put the two of them, their relationship, under a microscope. Does she really want to open this can of worms? She's suddenly frightened of what he might say next. She's frightened of being alone, of being left. She has a career, but she doesn't feel that independent. Financially, a divorce would ruin both of them. They both know that. If he wants out, she thinks, terrified, he must be desperately unhappy. Maybe it's too late. She feels like a fool for not seeing this coming, for not knowing what he was thinking. All this slips through her mind in a flash as she stands there exposed in her expensive negligee, goosebumps appearing on her chest and arms, embarrassed in front of her own husband. She folds her arms in front of her breasts, which are billowing out of her nightgown in what now seems to be an unseemly fashion. Perhaps he is finished with her. Her thoughts are speeding away with her like a runaway train headed for catastrophe. She longs for her thick, terry bathrobe to cover herself, but is too stunned to move. She sinks down onto the bed, takes a deep, ragged breath, and says, "What do you mean?" He sighs and says, sounding regretful, "We haven't been happy, Beverly, for a long time." She doesn't know how to respond to that. Of course they haven't been happy. Her friends, with big mortgages, demanding jobs, problem teenagers, and aging parents, aren't happy either. It's impossible at this stage of their lives, with all the demands and stresses they face. He's simply being childish, she thinks, looking back at him in disbelief. He's probably having some kind of middle-age crisis, like some spoiled child who wants to be happy all the time, who doesn't understand that you can't always be happy. Life doesn't work that way. Henry can't be one of those men who realizes one day that he's miserable and decides to chuck it all and do what he wants. Surely not. She can't just throw everything aside and do what she wants so that she can be happy. Women don't get to make fools of themselves like that. Society won't let them. But men do it all the time. She feels bitterness rising in her heart, not only against him, but against the world. She feels so powerless, more powerless than he is. She has never had the selfishness or even the time to ask herself what would make her happy. She sits looking at him, thinking how close she is to losing everything. But maybe it's not too late. If he would just say he spoke too hastily, that of course he loves her and wants to make it work, that they've had things stacked against them, he knows that. It's been hard for both of them, and they have to somehow help each other, try harder to be content together. Then, She's sure they could love each other again. She's not ready to give up. Not yet. But she waits, and he doesn't say it. Finally, she says, "What do you mean? You haven't been happy." She sounds so controlled, but she wants to smack him as if he were a pouting child. That's what he is to her right now, a selfish child, and she wishes she could straighten him out the way she used to be able to straighten out the kids before they became willful, unmanageable teenagers. When he still says nothing, she adds, "And what makes you think you have a greater right to happiness than anyone else? Than me, for instance, or Teddy, or Kate?" Henry looks at his wife with veiled loathing. He hates when she gets like this, all high and mighty. She's such a martyr. She has no idea how hard that's been to live with. How joyless must life be? She's a miserable woman, constantly complaining. At least it seems that way to him. Maybe he's not being fair, he thinks now, rather guiltily. She is so exposed in that skimpy new nightgown that he feels a sudden pity for her. But he is still unable to reach out to comfort her. He wonders how other people see his wife. What do Ted and Kate think of their mother? He doesn't really know. They complain that she nags them too much, but she clearly loves them. She's a good mother. He knows that. He doesn't know how the kids feel about either one of them. He doesn't know what teenagers feel at all. He loves his children, but he no longer loves their mother, which is what makes this so hard. He doesn't want to hurt them or damage them in any way. He's stuck between the proverbial rock and hard place. And now he's found himself here, snowed in with her for the weekend. What will they do with all this time they have together? "I don't think I have a greater right to happiness than you or the kids," he answers her stiffly. Surely that's not it. How typical of her to hear his "we haven't been happy" as "I haven't been happy." He doesn't think he's more important than the kids are, or than she is. He doesn't think she's happy either. The difference between them is that he can see it, and she can't. Or maybe it's just that he can admit it, that he might be willing to do something about it. Perhaps, by the end of the weekend, things will somehow be clearer. Friday, 11:30 p.m. Gwen knows she's being reckless, but she doesn't care. Something has happened to her, and she's opening herself up to it. Perhaps it's the Veuve Clicquot that's gone to her head, or maybe it's the way he smells, like expensive soap and imported suits, and he hasn't even touched her yet. David has Bradley bring them more champagne. Bradley freshens up the fire, then discreetly pulls the library door closed behind him. "I like that boy," David says, and she giggles as he refills their glasses. In the library, they talk. She loves the sound of his voice, especially now when he's talking to her alone. It's lower, more intimate, but gruffer somehow, and it makes her feel desired. When he speaks low, he moves in close, so that she can hear, and she leans in more toward him, too. They both know what's going to happen. When they reach his room, he'd offered to walk her to hers, but she shook her head. He closes the door behind them with a soft click, and she shivers. She doesn't move. She waits in the dark. He reaches behind her neck and unclasps her necklace and removes it, and she feels as if he's undressed her. She breathes in, a little gasp, waiting. He gently drops the necklace, costume jewelry but pretty, on the bureau just inside the door. Then he kisses her. The kiss releases something in her that's been pent up too long, and she kisses him back, but not frantically, slowly, as if she's still not sure. And he seems to get that, as if he's not entirely sure either. Beverly has a difficult time falling asleep. She always does when she's away from the kids. And now, her world is falling apart. It doesn't help that she can hear a muffled argument coming from the room next door, Dana and Matthew's room. Is no one happy? It annoys her that Henry fell asleep so quickly, as if he didn't have a care in the world, and now he's snoring away. She doesn't know what's going to happen to them. She resents that she has to do the worrying for both of them. It always falls to her to do all the emotional work. They'd agreed to stop talking about their marriage before either of them said something they might regret. They agreed to sleep on it and see how they felt in the morning. Finally, deep into the night, she's falling asleep at last when she hears a muffled scream. But sleep has her now, and the scream becomes part of a dream, a nightmare. Someone is trying to suffocate her. In that strange way of dreams, she is screaming loudly, even while someone holds a pillow firmly to her face. Saturday, 1:35 a.m. Riley lies in her bed, staring at the ceiling. She wonders when Gwen will come to bed. According to her watch, it's after 1:30 in the morning. She doesn't think for a minute that Gwen and David have been in a library all this time. She's gone to his room. She's gone to bed with him. Maybe she will spend the entire night with him and not come back to their room at all until morning. It makes her terribly uneasy. The panic is rising inside her like a tide. Not because she's a prude. Far from it. She's had a lot of lovers. And not because she's jealous either, but because she's certain that there's some cloud hanging over this David Paley. She just can't remember what it is. Again, she curses the lack of an internet connection. She fights an irrational urge to get up and go knock on David Paley's door, but she doesn't even know which room he's in. She hates this constant, generalized anxiety she always feels now. She tells herself that nothing can possibly happen to Gwen here, among all these people. Riley knows that Gwen is with him. Finally, she slips uneasily toward sleep. As she drifts off, she thinks she hears a scream somewhere far away. She persuades herself it's not a scream, but a memory. She often hears screams as she's drifting off to sleep. She's used to it. They're a precursor to the nightmares. Chapter 8. Saturday, 5:45 a.m. Morning comes slowly. Overnight, the falling snow, so peaceful, has turned to sleet, coating everything in brittle ice, making the landscape even more dangerous to navigate. It seems everything is about to snap. Inside the inn, there's a distinct chill in the air. Lauren rises early, freezing, even with the warmth of Ian pressed up beside her. Her neck is stiff. She gets out of bed, shivering, and hurries to put warm clothes on, wondering why it's so damn cold. She slips on jeans, a t-shirt, a heavy sweater, warm socks. They hadn't closed the drapes before they went to bed, and now she glances out the front window to the landscape below. Even though it's still quite dark, she can see that the branches of the huge tree in the front yard are bent, weighted down with ice. She sees where one of them has broken off. There's a large pale gash where it has been ripped from the trunk. The heavy limb lies broken in three separate pieces on the ground below. She walks quietly into the bathroom, leaving the door open. She doesn't want to turn on the light. She doesn't want to wake Ian. It's damn cold. She brushes her hair quickly. Her illuminated watch face says it's just before 6. She wonders what time the staff gets up and starts their day. She glances back at Ian snoring in their bed, only his head showing above the covers. He won't be up for a while. She opens the door quietly. It's dark in the corridor. The lights in the wall sconces are out. She slips out and walks down the third floor hall to the main stairs in her thick socks. She doesn't want to wake anyone. She turns toward the staircase to the lobby, wondering how long it will be before she can get a cup of coffee. Saturday, 6:03 a.m. Riley wakens suddenly, sitting up abruptly in bed, eyes wide open. She thinks she's heard a scream, loud and piercing. Her heart is pounding, and she can feel the familiar adrenaline surging through her body. She glances quickly around the dim hotel room and remembers where she is. She turns to the other bed beside her, throwing aside the bed covers, and is immediately accosted by the cold. Gwen is awake, too, and alert. "What's going on?" Gwen says. "I thought I heard something."
"I don't know. I heard it, too."
For a moment, they remain perfectly still, listening. They hear a woman's voice, shouting. Riley throws her legs over the bed and pulls on her robe against the chill, while Gwen scrambles to do the same, saying, "Wait for me." Riley grabs the key as the two of them slip out the door. The third-floor corridor is unexpectedly dark, and they stop suddenly, disoriented. Riley remembers that she needs to talk to Gwen about last night, but now is not the time. She's just grateful to have Gwen here with her. She doesn't know what she would do if anything happened to Gwen.
"The power must be out," Gwen says.
Riley and Gwen make their way to the grand staircase, barefoot. Holding onto the polished rail, they race down the stairs, as other footsteps can be heard running in the darkened hotel. Then Riley stops abruptly. The faint light coming in through the front windows illuminates a ghastly sight below her. Dana lies sprawled at the bottom of the stairs, perfectly still, her limbs in an unnatural position beneath her navy satin robe. Her lovely long dark hair spills all around her, but her face has an unmistakable pallor. She knows immediately that Dana is dead. Lauren is kneeling on the floor beside her, leaning over her, her hand pressed against Dana's neck, feeling for a pulse. She looks up at them, stricken.
"I just found her."
Her voice is strained. Riley continues slowly down the stairs until she is standing on the last step, right above the body. She can feel Gwen's presence behind her, hears her broken sob.
"Was that you who screamed?" Riley asks.
Lauren nods, tearful. Riley notices Bradley and his father James standing nearby. James is staring at the body of the dead woman at the bottom of his staircase, his face slack with shock. Bradley seems unable to look at Dana, staring at Lauren instead as she hovers over the body. Then James moves forward and reaches down hesitantly. "She's dead," Lauren tells him. He pulls his hand back, almost gratefully. David hears the scream and jumps out of bed. He throws on a bathrobe, grabs his key, and leaves his room. At the top of the landing, he pauses and looks down at the ragged little gathering below. He sees Dana, clearly dead, lying at the foot of the stairs in her bathrobe, Lauren beside her. Riley and Gwen have their backs to him. James is pale, and Bradley looks suddenly much younger than he did last night. David hears a noise above him, glances up quickly, and sees Henry and Beverly coming after him, also still in their pajamas, drawing their robes closed and tying them shut.
"What happened?"
David says, hurrying down the stairs.
"We don't know,"
James says, his voice shaking.
"It looks like she fell down the stairs."
David comes closer.
"I couldn't find a pulse,"
Lauren says. David squats down and studies the body without touching it, a grimness taking hold of him. Finally, he says,
"She's been dead for a while. She must have fallen in the middle of the night."
He wonders aloud,
"Why would she have been out of her room?"
He's noted the terrible gash on the side of her head, the blood on the edge of the bottom step. He takes it all in with a practiced eye and feels unaccountably weary.
"Dear God," Beverly whispers, "that poor girl."
David looks up at the rest of them. Beverly has turned her face away, but Henry is staring solemnly at the body. David glances at Gwen. Her face is tear-stained, and her lower lip is trembling. He longs to comfort her, but he doesn't. Riley is staring at the dead woman as if she can't tear her eyes away. He notices then that Matthew is missing.
Someone has to tell Matthew, he says, his heart sinking, knowing it will probably be him.
He takes one more look at James, and then at all the stricken faces now staring back at him as they remember Matthew.
I'll do it.
Standing up, he adds,
we'd better call the police. We can't, James says harshly. The power's out, and the phone. We can't contact the police.
Then someone has to go get them, David says.
How? Bradley asks. Look outside. Everything is a sheet of ice.
James shakes his head slowly.
The power lines must be down because of the ice storm. It's hazardous out there. Nobody's going anywhere.
He adds, his voice taking on an uncertain note.
It's probably going to be a while before the police can get here.
Candace's alarm on her cell phone is set to go off promptly every morning at 6:30. She's nothing if not disciplined. She is a light sleeper, however, and this morning, something wakes her before the alarm sounds. She's not sure what. She hears footsteps running along the hall below her, raised voices. She decides she'd better get up. Plus, it's goddamn cold. She flicks the light switch of the lamp on her bedside table, but it doesn't go on. It's very dark in the room. She crosses the floor, shivering in bare feet to open the drapes. She's surprised by what she sees. Not the fluffy winter wonderland of last night, but the unleashed fury of an ice storm. Obviously, the power is out. Fuck. Fuck, fuck, fuck. She wonders how much battery she's got left in her laptop. Maybe 5 hours max. This is a disaster. She needs to find out when the power is going back on. She quickly pulls on some warm clothes and heads cautiously downstairs in the dark. As she rounds the landing and sees down the stairs into the lobby, she stops abruptly. There's a cluster of people at the bottom of the stairs, and they all glance up toward her. Every one of their faces is drawn and uneasy. And then she sees why. There's a woman lying at the bottom of the stairs, so still that she is clearly dead. It's Dana Hart. The attorney is standing over her, his face serious. There's no sign of Matthew. David has volunteered to break the terrible news to Matthew, who, as far as they know, is still up in his room. Properly speaking, he supposes that it's the duty of the owner of the hotel to inform Matthew, but James doesn't look up to the task. This is what David tells himself as he treads back up. James accompanies him, obviously grateful that the attorney has offered. The others remain behind, standing in place, dumbly watching their quiet progress up the stairs.
Which room is it?
David asks.
Room 201,
James tells him in a distraught voice. They stop outside the door. David pauses, preparing himself. He listens for any sounds within, but he hears nothing. He lifts his hand and knocks firmly. There's no response. David glances at James, who appears even more anxious. David knocks again, harder this time. He's beginning to think about having James go fetch the key when he hears movement within. Finally, the door swings open, and David is face to face with the man he met over cocktails the night before. David suddenly feels a terrible pity for him. Matthew still looks half asleep. He's clumsily pulling on a bathrobe. Yes, he says, obviously surprised to find them at his door. Then he glances over his shoulder at the bed he's just gotten out of, as if he's missing something. He turns back and looks David in the eye.
and it registers all at once. Matthew's eyes sharpen. What is it? He looks from David to the visibly upset James and back to the attorney. What's happened? Where's Dana?
I'm afraid there's been an accident, David says in his professional voice.
What?
Matthew is clearly alarmed now. I'm so sorry, David says quietly.
Has something happened to Dana?
Matthew's voice is full of panic. She's fallen down the stairs, David says.
Is she okay?
But his face has gone white. David shakes his head somberly and says the dreaded words again. I'm so sorry. Matthew gasps.
I don't believe it.
He looks ghastly.
I want to see her.
There's nothing to be done. He must see her. David leads him down to the landing where he stops, respectfully. Dana lies below them like a broken doll, thrown across a room by a petulant child. Matthew sees her, cries out, and stumbles past him in his rush to get to his beloved. Don't touch her, David advises. Matthew collapses beside her and begins to sob as the others step back. He ignores David's warning and strokes her too pale face, runs his thumb along her bloodless lips in disbelief. Then he buries his face in her neck, his shoulders heaving. The others look away. It's unbearable. Finally, Matthew looks up.
How did this happen?
He cries, half crazed at David, who has descended the stairs and has stopped above him on the second step.
Why would she even be out of our room?
You didn't hear her go? David asks. Matthew shakes his head slowly in shock and misery.
No, I was asleep. I didn't hear anything.
He covers his face with both hands and weeps wretchedly. Bradley fetches a white sheet, and they all stand by somberly as he and David settle it gently over Dana's inert form. Chapter 9. Saturday, 6:33 a.m. Gwen walks with Riley back to their room as if in a trance. She can't seem to take it all in. Dana is dead. Just like that. She might have fallen down those stairs and died while Gwen was in David's room last night. It's possible she was already lying at the bottom of the stairs on the first floor when she left his room on the second floor and climbed to the third floor to her own room. How fleeting and precious life is, she realizes. You never know when it may be snatched from you, just when you're least expecting it. Dana had everything to live for, Gwen thinks. It's too horrible. It makes her realize that she should try to enjoy every moment. Live life to the fullest. She hasn't been very good at that. Maybe it's time to try. Maybe it's time to let go of the baggage, the guilt, and try to live her life, she thinks. Maybe last night is a new beginning for her. She feels a surging warmth and happiness inside about David that she can't help, even though Dana is dead. She'd wanted so much to go to him just now, but it would have been completely inappropriate. They'd managed a warm glance at one another, but that was it. There was time. They would be together again. Riley won't like it that she was with David last night. Gwen knows that. But Riley is her friend, not her keeper. Riley should be happy for her that she's met someone. Gwen was always happy for Riley when she met someone, and Gwen usually didn't have anyone special herself. She's sorry it had to happen when they were supposed to be spending time together this weekend, but you must take good things when and where you find them. They are rare enough. Dana's dreadful accident has brought this home to her. Riley should understand that. It's not like she planned it this way. They reach the room, and Riley closes the door behind her. Gwen looks up at her warily, waiting for her to say something. When she doesn't, Gwen reaches for some clothes from her overnight bag. She would like a shower, but that seems out of the question. The water will be freezing. There is something I need to say, Riley says at last, her voice serious as she pulls a top on over her head.